I will be reading our scripture passage this morning, the book of Job, chapter 1. There was a man in the country of Uz named Job. He was a man of complete integrity who feared God and turned away from evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. His estate included 7,000 sheep and goats, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large number of servants. Job was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to take turns having banquets at their homes. They would send an invitation to their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. Whenever a round of banqueting was over, Job would send for his children and purify them, rising early in the morning to offer burnt offerings for all of them. For Job thought, "Perhaps my children have sinned, having cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular practice. One day, the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord asked Satan, "Where have you come from?" "From roaming through the earth," Satan answered him, "and walking around on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? No one else on earth is like him, a man of perfect integrity who fears God and turns away from evil." Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Haven't you placed a hedge around him, his household, and everything he owns? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he owns, and he will surely curse you to your face." "Very well," the Lord told Satan, "everything he owns is in your power. However, do not lay a hand on Job himself." So Satan left the Lord's presence. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and reported, "While the oxen were plowing and the donkeys grazing nearby, the Sabaeans swooped down and took them away. They struck down the servants with the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." He was still speaking when another messenger came and reported, "God's fire fell from heaven. It burned the sheep and the servants and devoured them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." That messenger was still speaking when yet another came and reported, "The Chaldeans formed 3 bands, made a raid on the camels, and took them away. They struck down the servants with the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." He was still speaking when another messenger came and reported, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. Suddenly, a powerful wind swept in from the desert and struck the 4 corners of the house. It collapsed on the young people so that they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job stood up, tore his robe, and shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshiped, saying, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will leave this life. The Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Throughout all this, Job did not sin or blame God for anything. This is the word of the Lord.
Whew. We're beginning a 12-week series in the book of Job, and you might be thinking, why would we do that? Well, the reason we're doing it is because suffering is the universal human experience. If there isn't somebody in here who has suffered, I will eat my hat. I'm not wearing one, but... And if you haven't, be prepared. Suffering will come for you. The reality is, living in life east of Eden, outside of the garden, is full of thorns and thistles and a real enemy that wants to steal, kill, destroy all that is good and beautiful. And so we've chosen the book of Job because we want to bring comfort to those who are currently suffering. We want to equip people who are walking alongside those who are currently suffering, and we want to cultivate wisdom in our community so that we know how to suffer well, and we understand as much as we can what suffering is actually all about. And finally, the book of Job will lead us as a community to an experience of awe and worship. And that is my aim in every single sermon, is to bring you into the presence of God who is alive and present, that you would be overwhelmed with numinous awe and wonder, and that you would worship. So, we have a long passage today. We have a long book ahead of us. And in order to orient us to some of what's going to be happening, I want to give you a little prologue of my own for the book and the series, and then we'll get into the story. So first, Job is a book that is, I think, probably the topic of some of the worst Christian trivia ever. We have all these ideas about what the book is about, what it does, and so there is no shame. At one point, I believed all the things I'm just about to tell you are wrong, okay? So if you currently believe these things, don't worry, so did I. But if we focus on them, we're going to miss the forest for the trees. So the first is, and I'm so sorry because I've recently had this conversation, and I'm so sorry. Job is not the oldest book in the Bible. I know many of you believe that. And for some like reasonable reasons, right? It's set in the time of the patriarchs, the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, early in Genesis. And so the idea is that this book was around long before the Bible came into being, that maybe Moses was a part of collecting it, etc. And that's just not the case. The book is set in the time of the patriarchs, but the incredible complexity of the language, the beauty of the Hebrew poetry, make that highly unlikely. Some of the names, like the Chaldeans or Neo-Babylonian, they're not 2000 BC, they're in the first century BC. And there's all sorts of weird anachronisms that are placed there intentionally by the author for a particular purpose, but it's definitely not the oldest book in the Bible. The story might be very, very old, but it's not as old as Genesis 1. Like, you don't get to a story of Job before the beginning, right? The second one, and this will be a little bit controversial, but hear me out, okay? Job is not history. Now, when we think of the word history, we think of an unbiased perspective, a neutral recorder of events that tells us what happened, and then we get to decide what they mean. And none of the Bible works like that. The Bible has a bias. It has a perspective. It has an agenda. And Job has an agenda. It has a perspective. It's not neutral. And it's not just recording the facts. Here's a good example. If you have just lost everything that you hold dear, it is highly unlikely that you will break into some of the most beautiful and prosaic like Hebrew poetry imaginable. Highly unlikely that you would do that. Higher unlikelihood that you've got three friends that can do the same and sustain a dialogue for multiple chapters. You know, like when you're going through suffering, it's why? Ow! It hurts. You know, like we're not Shakespearean characters. However, just like Shakespeare, that doesn't mean it's not accurate. It doesn't mean that the book of Job isn't accurate to the human experience. And in fact, it, in a way that I can't think of any other work in all of history or even the Bible that plumbs the depth of human suffering with such deftness, such beauty, such emotional honesty. It is accurate to our experience. And maybe it's accurate to the story of Job. It is probable that there was a person a long time ago that had a lot, that lost it all, and went through suffering. And we see that there are multiple civilizations like Egypt, Babylon, and the ancient Near East in the kind of Levant area that have stories similar to this one. Somebody has a lot of stuff, they're amazing, they lose it all, and they go through the struggle of trying to understand why. And they do that in all sorts of different ways. Some of them will talk to their deity, some of them will talk to friends, but it seems like Job is kind of like built on the structure like we have for, say, Westerns. A Western movie starts off with like the little town, it's doing all right, and then the bad guys come in, and then the guy with the white hat shows up, and he's got a fast arm, and you know, like, you can watch the same movie 20 different times, and they're playing with all of the different genre conventions of the Western. It's probable that Job was a set story that a Hebrew author took and said, actually, I know something about Yahweh, and something about reality that this story can be helpful in telling. So, not history, but it is accurate. And maybe, again, there was a guy named Job. I should give a caveat here. I am going to go very quickly. I could take 4 to 8 hours this morning on just this chapter, and I would love to do it. I've been looking forward to this for so long. And I'll tell you why in a little bit. But so if you have questions, like, come see me afterwards. I'm going to be right here. If you're new and you're like, what kind of church is this? Show up at the front. Like, we'll have a little chat. Okay. So not the oldest book, not history, not theodicy. And theodicy is kind of the way of justifying God's character in the face of suffering. And it's built on this kind of problem of evil. And the problem of evil goes something like this. If God is all good and all powerful, why is there suffering? It's a syllogism, which is A is true, B is true, C must be true. So, like, all pianos are instruments. A baby grand is a piano, therefore a baby grand piano is an instrument, right? That would be a syllogism. And the problem of evil rests on a syllogism that assumes that all three premises are true. God is good, God is all-powerful, suffering exists, there's a problem. But the syllogism assumes that there is nothing redemptive about suffering. So the problem of evil is internally coherent in the Bible when it says, actually, there is something redemptive and good that can come out of evil. It's not a problem for the Bible. But here's the thing. Job isn't a theodicy. Job doesn't answer that question. Job doesn't even address the question, really. And so that brings me to my fourth point, which is we bring a lot of questions to the book. And these are good questions. Why am I hurting? Why am I suffering? Is God good? Does God love me? Why is there suffering? We bring all these questions to the book that Job does not answer. Well, he'll answer that God is good and all-powerful and loves you. But he's not interested, the author is not interested in giving us a theodicy, is not interested in answering all of our questions. Instead, Job gives us bigger answers to more important questions. And if we focus on our questions first, we might miss those bigger answers. And so I want to encourage you as you're going through this study to bring your questions, wrestle with them honestly, but don't miss the forest for the trees. Finally, you might ask, what kind of book is this? If it's not a theodicy, if it's not a history, and I'd propose that it's wisdom literature. Wisdom literature is meant to not only cultivate wisdom, but also character. That we would be the kind of people that can live in a world as it is with skill and faithfulness to Yahweh. And also, I'm going to say Yahweh a lot because we're in the Old Testament, and that is God's name. His name is not Bob. His name is not God. His name is Yahweh. That's what he's revealed it as. And so if I introduce myself as Tom, it feels real weird if you start calling me pastor. If I introduce myself as Tom, it feels real weird if you start calling me Muhammad. Like, his name is Yahweh, and he's revealed it to us so that we know that we have a personal God that we can have relationship with and desires relationship with us. So, the purpose of the book is to comfort and provide wisdom. The purpose of the series is to provide comfort and wisdom, to equip those who are walking with others, to prepare us all to suffer well and with wisdom, and to lead us into worship of our mysterious King. Now, for this sermon, I'm just going to walk through the story. It's dramatic. It's beautiful. And it doesn't really require me doing much. I want to bring out the beauty that is latent in the text and then provide some clarifying thoughts that focus on the main point here. So, we ready? Yeah. Questions afterwards, right here? Right? Okay. Job, chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. There was a man in the country of Uz named Job. He was a man of complete integrity who feared God and turned away from evil. Now, besides Jesus, there is no one in the Bible that comes off so good as Job. Now, I know that some of us are coming from a, more of a systematic theology background where we've got some things really nailed down, and we know that human beings can't be sinless. Fair enough. However, in the literary art of the book of Job, Job never sins. He's never described as a sinner. He never sins. At the very end, God says everything he said was right. Nobody comes off so good as Job. So again, this isn't a history. This is a wisdom literature book. We're meant to learn wisdom from this character that is given to us through the literary art of the Holy Spirit and his human writers. And Job is described as a man of complete integrity, blameless and upright. It's a moral wholeness. It's not that he's virtuous and he has all these virtues that he's tossing out, but it's, as one commentator has said, it's like the internal operating system from which all the virtues come out of. He is a righteous, upright, blameless human being who fears God. And the fear of the Lord is a stock phrase in wisdom literature. And if we get it wrong, it's going to be real bad news for us later down the road. Actually, it's going to be real bad news for you in your life. If you think that you really need to fear God, be really afraid of him, you might create this caricature in your mind of a very scary God who just can't wait to smite you and ruin your life. And that's not the picture that we get in Job. That's not the picture we get in the Bible. Fear of the Lord is a technical stock phrase that is associated with wisdom literature. The beginning of wisdom is fear of the Lord. And what fear of the Lord is mainly about is a relationship to Yahweh that recognizes who he is, his majesty, his beauty, and responds with awe and wonder and a healthy respect. It's humility in recognizing our relationship to our Creator. So he is personifying wisdom. He fears God and turns away from evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. His estate includes 7,000 sheep and goats, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large number of servants, or too many servants to count. Job was the greatest man among all the people of the East. So we see Job's character and his wealth. His kids add up to the number 10. His wealth all adds up to 10,000. It's good round numbers. And the Bible loves numbers. Hebrew poetry loves numbers. 10 is a number associated with completeness. It's also a number associated with royalty. And it's also a number associated with testing and trial. And so with an economy of words, the author has clued you in. This guy is perfectly wealthy, but also he might be ripe for a test. In Job 1, 4 through 5, we see that his sons used to take turns having banquets at their homes. They would send an invitation to their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And whenever a round of banqueting was over, Job would send for his children and purify them, rising early in the morning to offer burnt offerings for all of them. For Job thought, perhaps my children have sinned, cursing God in their hearts. And this was his regular practice. Now, the author is trying to present Job and his family as the ideal. He has everything you want. He is wise. He is good. He is wealthy. Even his kids get along. My goodness. Right? Everything you want. Everything you've always wanted. In spades. In perfection. 10. There are some views that say Job's kids are miscreants, they're partying all the time, they're engaging in drunkenness and dissipation and blah, 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 blah. That is not what the author is trying to do, and so I think it's a misreading of the text to assume that's what's going on. In fact, Job's conversation partners, his pals later on, are going to look back on this partying and say, maybe your kids had it coming to them, which, hot tip, don't say to somebody who is suffering loss. We'll get to that later. This is the ideal family. This is the ideal picture of flourishing, again, in the East, east of Eden, outside of the Promised Land. Outside of the Promised Land, this man is enjoying the blessing of Eden. He's enjoying the fruitfulness and the fullness of all of God's blessing and flourishing. And if you know Genesis 1 through 3, maybe you might think, oh man, Eden, and isn't that like right around the time a snake slips into the garden? And that's what you see next. But first, let me pause for a second and talk about Job and his kids. Parenting is hard. Getting kids to like each other, difficult, right? Maybe they end up growing up and being close. Maybe they don't. The picture of Job is a man who is morally upright, but has also discipled his children through his life patterns, through what he values, what he prioritizes, to be reverent and to follow Yahweh. He is afraid because of his reverence, not because he has reason to fear. He acts like a priest because of who he is, not out of necessity. And so for parents, I think just pausing later today and asking yourself, what are my life patterns communicating to my kids? What do we as a family prioritize? What is the highest value? What are the things that my kids, without having a conversation with me, might conclude that I think is the most important thing in this world? How do you spend your time? How do you spend your money? What do you love? What do you talk about? Are you leading your children into intimacy with God or intimacy with something or someone else? Do you have cause to be afraid that they would blaspheme God in their heart? Or is your pattern to pray for them, to care for them, to act as a priest that mediates the relationship between them and their God until they are ready to step into that relationship themselves? And for folks who aren't parents, right here, you know, God promises those who follow Jesus that he will put them in families and that they will have more children than they know what to do with. And you can be a parent without ever producing your own blood offspring in this church. What do your patterns say to one another? How are you parenting the generation that's coming behind you? How are you discipling one another? Is it intimacy with God? Is it intimacy with someone or something else? All right, back into the garden. We should expect a snake to show up on the scene. And here we are in Job 1, 6 through 7a. One day, the sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh, and Satan also came with them. Yahweh asked Satan, "Where have you come from?" And so we're brought up into the divine council. The way that God runs the universe is not as just a solo dude that's got his fingers in all the pies and making all the gears turn and running everything. God, in his freedom, has decided to work with partners. He works with the sons of God, which is another way of talking about angelic beings, spiritual beings, and this is called, in Bible scholarship, the divine council. So he works with a team to administrate his rule in the universe. We go up to the throne room, and all of a sudden, the Satan comes along. The Hebrew actually says ha-Satan, which would be a way of saying the Satan. Some have concluded that this is not capital S Satan, the snake, the devil, the supreme enemy of everything good and beautiful and true, but this is an office in a courtroom scene. Maybe. The ha would be like our the, and it's a way of either calling attention to an office or it's calling attention to character. What is this being all about? Satan, accusation. This is the one who accuses. I think, for me personally, I don't think the book of Job in particular cares so much. And I think that future Bible writers will look back and say, this is capital S Satan. And so if that's a problem for you, like, let's talk about it afterwards. For me, I'm just going to say this is capital S Satan. Sound good? Cool. What is he doing here? And why? How did he get in? Oh my gosh! Shouldn't there be like locks? I'd be much more comfortable with like the office of the accuser. My goodness. So in Revelation 12, It seems like when Jesus Christ was put to death on the cross and died and was resurrected, something happened in the relationship between heaven and Satan, that he no longer has access to God's throne room. Revelation 12 says he's been cast down, no longer has access, as we see here. Romans 8 tells us that nobody can bring a charge against God's elect because God justifies. Nobody can accuse God's elect because Jesus Christ has died, been resurrected, and exalted to the throne room. And he stands in mediation before the throne of God for us. And so this is not what's going on in your life. Like, if you are suffering right now, Satan didn't sneak up into heaven and talk to God about how he'd like to put you to the test. That is 100% not what's going on. That's not what the book is saying. However, in this story, that uncomfortable truth is on display. I don't think this is normative. I think this is wisdom literature. We're supposed to learn something from it. And it's very uncomfortable. But notice how the devil replies. He says, from roaming the earth, going here and there. It's evasive. It's irreverent. He's like, somewhere. I've been around. Whatever. No reverence for God. And then Yahweh says to Satan in verse 8, "Have you considered my servant Job? No one else on earth is like him, a man of perfect integrity who fears God and turns away from evil." I've heard one writer put it this way. A jewelry store owner is locking up for the night. A thief breaks in. The jewelry store owner says, "What are you doing here?" The thief says, "Oh, I'm here to steal diamonds." The jewelry store owner says, "Have you seen my best one?" Now, that can't be what's going on. Yahweh is not a bumbler. He's not stupid. He's not getting tricked. Satan has been evasive, and God's going to flush out his agenda. And so he says, "Have you seen my servant Job?" He's proud of Job. He loves Job. He puts him on display. He says, "This is my servant." So in the first section, we see Job as a king. In the second section, we see Job as a priest. And now we see Job as a prophet. Servant is the way God describes his prophets throughout, who have been commissioned throughout the Old Testament, who have been commissioned for a purpose, for a mission. So Job is a prophet, a priest, and a king. And Yahweh says he's amazing. He's perfect in integrity. He fears me, and he turns away from evil. He boasts. And it's a calculated move to bring to light what Satan is all about. And so Satan answered Yahweh and says, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Haven't you placed a hedge around him, his household, and everything he owns? You've protected him. You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he owns, and he will surely curse you to your face." Whew. Can you imagine? And for me, now this is just me, I feel like this would be like a smiting moment, get out of here, twerp. But what we learn, remember, literary art, wisdom literature, what we learn, what is disclosed in Satan's response is, he hasn't just been, around. Yes, in fact, he has been considering God's servant Job. Yes, he has been paying attention. Yes, he is aware. And yes, this is his agenda. Suffering is his plan, and his goal is to discredit God and to destroy Job. That is Satan's agenda. And that is Satan's agenda in your life. There is a real spiritual enemy, and it really wants to kill you. It really wants to destroy you. Bless you, Shelby. It really wants to ruin your life, and it really wants to separate you from the one that loves you the most. And that real spiritual enemy in the process also wants to discredit and make God less beautiful. See, Satan has a cynical narrative. The only reason Job is such a good guy is because you're bribing him, God. You've protected him. You've bought him off. The righteous person is righteous because he gets stuff out of it. And this is the central question of the book. Not why do the righteous suffer, but But why are the righteous righteous? Why are you good? Why do you follow Jesus? Is it because of the benefits? Is it because you hope to get something out of it? Let's just say that's the case. But instead of, well, I hope he'll reward me in this life, the answer is, well, I hope he'll reward me in the next life. Would that not be the same thing, just a different location of the benefit that you hope for? Satan's charge is that God's people only serve him because they think they're going to get something out of it. And if the basis of your relationship with God is that you hope to get to heaven, or that you hope to get something out of it, I would propose to you that you have placed the foundation of your relationship in the wrong place. And I don't think it's going to hold. And especially during suffering. Satan has the cynical narrative that God is actually not beautiful, not lovely, not worth loving on his own, not wanting just for who he is, that he has to bribe his servants with promises of reward and protection. He uses an Imlo curse formula. Sweet. We're learning all sorts of Hebrew stuff here. Imlo curse formula. When he says, surely, he will surely curse you, he uses a technical phrase that is the equivalent of us saying, I'll be damned. Not like the old timer would say, like, ah, I'll be damned, but like, I'll be damned. If I'm wrong, I'll be defeated. I'll be cursed. Imlo, whatever I'm saying would happen, if it doesn't happen, let it come back on me, essentially. So God isn't playing dice. He's not wagering. He's not betting, but Satan is. Satan is betting everything on Job cursing God. And if Job doesn't curse God, Satan has been defeated, or at very least, proven wrong. Now notice that suffering is not Yahweh's idea. Satan brings it up. And in verse 12, we see that Yahweh says, very well, everything he owns is in your power. However, do not lay a hand on Job himself. So Satan left Yahweh's presence. Now, Satan has real power, real influence, and I would say still does. The New Testament tells us that he is the prince and power of the air, the king of this world. But God is more powerful. God limits Job's, or limits Satan's power, limits his ability to afflict Job, right? And this brings up a question of what most Christians that have been around for long enough call sovereignty. Does everybody know the word sovereignty? Yes, yes. Everybody has heard this word sovereignty. Does everybody know what that means? Does everybody have deep emotional feelings about that word? Right? So we've started to use a word that we don't really know what we mean by it all the time, but it's deeply important. And if we get the answer wrong, some people will think we don't believe God is all-powerful. I think it's more helpful in our context to think of sovereignty as freedom. Sovereignty in the vague, like kind of nebulous, I think I know what it means, usually I've spent a lot of time with y'all and I've spent a lot of time with Christians. Usually it means God is in charge of everything and involved in everything. It's what theologians call meticulous providence. He plans even the specks of dust where they're gonna fall in the window light. The Bible doesn't talk about specks of dust in the window. And maybe that's true, but is it like super helpful? Is it helpful in the midst of suffering? But if we think of sovereignty as God's rule in his freedom, God is free to do whatever he wants to do, and that includes limiting himself. God is free to run the universe in a way that accords with who he is. Freedom is not like I can do whatever I want to do. because I'm only going to do what I want to do that is coherent and congruent with who I am, right? So there's this idea of free will has to include contrary choice, but I'm never going to choose to jump off a cliff just to prove that I'm free, right? Like, that would be stupid. But I may choose to limit myself in a particular area in order to allow other people to exercise their freedom. And this is what we see in the Bible over and over again. God is free to rule as king with all power, and yet often he chooses to, in his freedom, limit himself. And so that's what I mean when I say that God is sovereign, that God is free. And so he limits Satan's power and maintains his own. And the question is, why would he even entertain the proposition? And I would say it's because Satan has brought a charge, an accusation, in a very public forum. He said, God is not good. His servants are only righteous because God bribes them. And if he really wants to play fair, he'll prove that he's good and his servants are actually righteous by keeping them in the dark and taking everything away from them and then seeing how they actually react when they don't have any benefit coming to them. Satan's proposition is that Job has built his life on getting stuff from God. He's built his life on it. And that's the foundation. And if you take the foundation away, he'll collapse. He'll crumble. And so the accusation must be publicly refuted. I think, again, I want to ask, how much of your life is built on stuff? What is the foundation of your life? What is the foundation of your relationship with God? Is it the hope for benefit? Or is it just God for who he is? See, a Christian finds God, or I'm sorry, a religious person finds God useful. And we can church that up in all sorts of language, but at the bottom of it, a religious person finds God useful. He makes me feel good things. This is fun. This is an adventure. He gives me good things. But a Christian finds God beautiful. A Christian loves God just because of who he is. Do you find God beautiful or do you find God useful? So then we read in verse 13, one day when Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and reported, while the oxen were plowing and the donkeys grazing nearby, the Sabians swooped down and took them away. They struck down the servants with the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And this happens again. While speaking, when another messenger came and reported God's fire fell from heaven, it burned the sheep and the servants and devoured them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And then that messenger was still speaking when yet another came and reported the Chaldeans formed three bands, made a raid on the camels, and took them away. They struck down the servants with the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. In quick succession, Job loses all of his wealth. And it's strange. It's strange because God's fire is mixed in with all of that. That's weird. And in verse 18, the servant was still speaking when another messenger came and reported, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. Suddenly a powerful wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on the young people so that they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Have you ever lost a child? Through miscarriage or otherwise? Have you ever lost something that was so dear to you that it felt like your heart was being ripped out of your chest? Maybe it wasn't a child, but it was a parent, it was a sibling, it was a close friend. Maybe it was the loss of who you thought you were. It felt stolen. In an instant, like, life has changed. What do you do? See, if your life is built on that, you will utterly collapse. You won't be able to handle it. Job loses everything. It's an eternal loss. You know, the wealth he can earn back, but you can't replace a child. And then the confusing part is God's fire. And the wind, natural disaster, is coming for Job. And I think what you realize, if you're familiar with the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy is like Moses' last speeches to Israel as they're about to enter into the promised land. And it lines out all of the hope for faithfulness to Yahweh, but also all of the covenant curses. If they turn their back on God, if they start serving other gods, if they start looking for value and meaning in other things, like the covenant curses come into effect. And if you read Deuteronomy 28, verses 25 through 35, you see in short succession that the oxen, the donkeys, the sheep, the camels, the servants and sons and daughters will be taken from you. And you realize Satan is framing God. Satan is trying to get Job to believe that God hasn't just removed his protection, but God hates you. You've disappointed him, and he is punishing you. Satan is not playing fair. And maybe in your own life, when you've gone through suffering, you've felt the same thing. Maybe not quite on the nose, as like there's a verse in the Bible about the consequences for something, and you're experiencing them. But I think there's this lie that the enemy tells us in the midst of suffering. God doesn't care about you. God isn't powerful. God doesn't love you. He's abandoned you. Will you believe the lie? Even in the face of what seems like incontrovertible evidence. If you read throughout the rest of the book of Job, they know their Bible. They'll be quoting from Deuteronomy left and right. They'll be quoting from other parts of the Old Testament. Here's what happens with Job. In verses 20 through 22, Job stood up, tore his robe, and shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshiped, saying, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will leave this life. Yahweh gives, and Yahweh takes away. Blessed be the name of Yahweh." Now, Job is going to have a very, very emotional response very, very soon. But this is his formal response. He goes through the conventions of grief and mourning. He stands up. He rips his clothes. He shaves his head. This isn't some emotional, like, really quick thing. It takes a little while to shave your head. He's maintained his poise, and he's maintained his faithfulness. It's like his whole life has led up to this moment, and he's prepared. It's like he is prepared for the suffering that has come on him, and he responds marvelously. Because in verse 22, it says, "Throughout all this, Job did not sin or blame God for anything." He maintains his commitment. He recognizes that Yahweh is the highest authority. He doesn't blame the Chaldeans. He doesn't blame the Sabians. He doesn't even blame God. It says he didn't blame God for anything. But he recognizes that God, in his freedom, has at very least allowed this to happen. He doesn't accuse God, and most certainly doesn't curse God, but instead, he blesses him. And the way that blessing works is when humans bless God, it's a means of expressing gratitude and respect, or calling others to ascribe value and to worship God. And so what Job is saying is, even though I've lost everything, I want God's reputation to be one of beauty and value of life. This is the shape of his life. This is the shape of Job's life. He's honest. He says, "I have nothing that God hasn't given me, but I have him." Now, there's some implications that suffering will come, but when it does, you still have God. And that can bring comfort, that the creator of all, in his sovereignty, in his freedom, will not abandon you. It can equip those who suffer with others to walk with them with patience and presence, non-judgmental. Job never finds out about this whole scene in heaven. never finds out about it. But you are given access to the throne room of God. You've been given the perspective of what's going on behind the scenes. You know that our easy answers are not always accurate, and actually are never accurate. Easy answers to complex questions, come on. It just doesn't go well, right? It can prepare you to build up your relationship of trust now, to recognize, oh, I've been building my life on this thing, on this benefit, on this thing I hope for, instead of building my life on God himself. I'm going to turn from that and turn towards God. And it gives you wisdom, because it recognizes, this passage recognizes that we are born into a war zone. Now, it's not two equal enemies duking it out for supremacy. It's not that kind of war. God is supreme, the supreme authority in all things. And yet, somehow in his wisdom, he has decided to allow for a little while a defeated enemy to still maintain and exercise power in this world. And so our easy answers aren't going to suffice, but it gives us wisdom to see there's more going on here than I can actually see with my two eyes. Let me conclude with this. Job exhibits poise and steadiness and grace in the midst of just unimaginable loss, catastrophic loss. Do you have that kind of poise? Do you have that kind of poise now? Do you want that kind of poise? I know I do. I want that steadiness that no matter what happens in my life, that I feel steady, that I feel secure. Maybe I don't have all the answers. Maybe I don't understand everything. But I have a foundation that can't be taken. Because there's a kind of loss that leads to despair. The kind of loss that leads to despair is the kind of loss that is your most valuable treasure is taken away from you, right? Maybe it's your kids, maybe it's your job, maybe it's your reputation, maybe it's your health. Whatever that thing is, if that is your foundation, then the loss of it leads to despair. But there's a kind of loss that leads to joy. Romans 5, 3 through 5 says, we also celebrate in our tribulations, or we rejoice in our suffering, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance proven character, and proven character hope, and hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who was given to us. God's personal presence was given to us. There's a kind of loss that leads to greater possession of what you most truly value. There's a kind of loss that drives you deeper and deeper and deeper into the heart of God. Deeper and deeper into the heart of the God who knows what it is to lose a son. Deeper and deeper into the heart of a God who knows what it is to suffer and die for what he loves the most. So you can build a life on that, and it can never be taken away from you. Not even in death, we are promised, can Jesus Christ be taken away from us. And so if you give yourself to him freely, not because of what you can get from him, but just because of who he is, Jesus is the one who came for you to be with you and one of us, to die for us and in our place and for our benefit, to be sure. But the primary benefit is a restored relationship of love with him and the Father and the Spirit. That's the kind of loss, or that's the kind of love that loss only drives us deeper into. You know, the book of Job has a message that I think, to me, it seems like it's on the face of it. It's just like right out in front. But maybe it feels a little bit more obscure to you. But if you want to be able to summarize what the book of Job is all about in one sentence, it's that the perfect prophet, priest, king, who faithfully suffers unjust suffering with endurance, with faithfulness. It's becoming a longer sentence now because I'm tearing up. The faithful prophet, priest, king who endures unjust suffering with faithfulness to Yahweh is uniquely qualified to defeat evil and mediate God's blessing to the nations. That's the book of Job. That's who Jesus is. He is our prophet, he is our priest, he is our king, he's endured suffering, he has defeated evil, and he mediates God's blessing to us because he gives us himself. Let me pray. Father, what can we say but we don't understand? We don't understand why you have created a good world that includes suffering. I mean, we can understand that a lot of it is because we have chosen to serve other things and ultimately aligned ourselves with evil spiritual beings, but we still don't understand. And I think for me, my hope is that one day when we see you face to face, there will be a comfort and an answer, not in like an idea, but because we see you, because we have you. And we will worship you now because that possession that we have you, that you've given us life together with you, is ours now. And so while we don't have answers, while we don't understand, we do have you. Meet with us now as we turn to you in worship and prayer and communion. Amen.